This is The Takeaway. I'm Nancy Solomon from WNYC News, sitting in for Tanzina Vega today. Tanzina's back later this week. Good to have you with us. Last week, President Biden announced the creation of a bipartisan commission that would study reforming the Supreme Court, including expanding it. Former President Trump's appointment of three justices cemented the ideologically conservative 6-3 tilt. His outsized influence on the court wouldn't have been possible without Senator Mitch McConnell's obstruction of Obama Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland back in 2016.
One of my proudest moments is when I looked at Barack Obama in the eye and I said, Mr. President, you will not fill this Supreme Court vacancy.
Although supporters have pressed President Biden, he's stopped short of voicing his opinion on whether or not he would support adding more justices to the court. Here he is on 60 Minutes last October.
I will ask them to, over 180 days, come back to me with recommendations as to how to reform the court system, because it's getting out of whack.
But even if President Biden should decide to pursue court expansion after the commission's findings, there's no guarantee that he has the support in Congress, even within his own party. We have with us Zoe Tillman, senior reporter with BuzzFeed News. Zoe, great to have you back on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me on.
And we also have Mark Joseph Stern, who writes about courts and the law for Slate. Welcome back, Mark.
Thanks so much for having me back on.
So, Zoe, let's start with you. What exactly will the commission be investigating?
The commission will be exploring a number of proposals that have been put forward in recent years to change not only the structure, but the operation and function of the Supreme Court. You know, the most high profile of those is court expansion or court packing, the potential addition of seats to the nine justices who are already there. But it's not limited to that. The commission has a broad mandate to explore all sorts of different reforms, including term limits, a system of rotating justices through the court over the course of X many years, various ethics reforms that watchdog groups would love to see, whether it's, you know, putting in place a formal code of ethics for the justices, increasing transparency rules that the justices have to abide by. You know, so it's not court packing, but that is certainly the most explosive of the list that the commission will be exploring.
And Mark, what do you think the chances are that this will lead to actual changes on the Supreme Court?
Slim to none. I think it's worth noting that the executive order does not actually task the commission with devising recommendations for the president or for Congress. Instead, it asks the members to devise the principal arguments for and against the various proposals that Zoe mentioned, and to provide some history and analysis that the president can use to sort of, I guess, marinate on these issues. That doesn't sound like a recipe for decisive action to me.
Now, Zoe, Biden as a candidate made it clear that he didn't support adding seats to the Supreme Court. So what's his motive in creating this commission now?
You know, the fact that the commission is happening at all, I think, reflects a groundswell of interest in doing something about the court from the left, which, you know, sat by for 4 years and watched with very little agency as the Trump administration, you know, filled three seats on the court. Also, the confirmation of more than 200, you know, mostly young, mostly conservative federal judges across the country. And there was very little that they could do about that as long as Republicans controlled the Senate. So, you know, during the campaign, thanks to the efforts of grassroots organizations that saw court packing or other ethics reform as really the only option here, they got the conversation going among candidates. And you had someone like Pete Buttigieg at an event really early in the campaign. You know, there was a planted question from one of these groups about court packing, and he said, I'm open to it. And that really, you know, cracked open the floodgates for other candidates to have to respond to this movement from the base to address this. And so I think there was a lot of pressure on President Biden to carry on, do something with that momentum once he took office. And, you know, it doesn't commit him, as Mark said, to doing anything. There have been other executive orders that directed similar commissions or councils to come up with policy recommendations. And this order does not do that. It doesn't even take that additional step. So it's a big step forward in the movement that the president had to do something, that he is taking official action, but it also really stops short of requiring anyone to do anything in the end.
What else is on the, in terms of the left wing of the party, what else is on their wish list? Is it more than just packing the court?
You know, I think it's, is there a way for the left to counterbalance the progress that President Trump and Republicans made over the past 4 years? You know, back in 2016, an argument was made to Republicans who might be a bit queasy about Trump as a candidate. You know, ignore everything. Just think about the judges, whether it's Supreme Court justices, lower court judges. These are lifetime appointments. That legacy is something that far outlasts even a two-term president. And so I think there's this sense among liberals that, you know, we have to do, they have to do something. And, you know, absent a huge number of resignations that open up seats, absent a seat opening up on the Supreme Court, and, you know, even if a Justice Breyer opens up, it steps down, that's still a more left-leaning seat. So absent, you know, Justice Alito leaving under President Biden, there aren't that many options to undo what Republicans did. And so I think there's the sense that, you know, liberals need to think outside the box here.
So let's talk about the makeup of the commission. It seems like they come from pretty elite backgrounds. Mark, tell us about them.
Yeah, so more than 80% of the members of this commission either graduated from or taught at Harvard or Yale, which shows you the very elite pedigree here. These are mostly either progressive or centrist scholars and law professors, with a handful of genuine conservatives. And I think it's worth noting this is not just a token conservative here. There are big names on the right, like Jack Goldsmith and Adam White and former Judge Thomas Griffith, who stepped down under Trump. They will be on this commission alongside these progressive academics who are all going to apparently work together to produce a report that does not, as I said, produce any action items, but has some analysis that the entire commission can sign on to, which suggests to me that there will be a kind of lowest common denominator factor here where, you know, Thomas Griffith on the right and Bob Bauer on the left are going to have to come together and figure out what they can write about Supreme Court reform that each of them can live with. I think it's worth noting that the progressive scholars and law professors on this commission are not really known for their advocacy of court reform. If you think about the scholars who have really stuck their neck out over the last few years to advocate for some kind of judicial reform, whether it's adding seats to the Supreme Court or expanding the lower judiciary or modifying the rules and procedures of the court, people like Steve Vladeck and Leah Littman, and Samuel Moyne, you don't see them on this commission. Instead, you see individuals who have really shied away from the battle, from the fight under Trump and under Obama before him, between the left and the right on courts. And so it's interesting that Biden doesn't seem to want to ruffle any feathers with the membership here. He doesn't seem to want to give any hints or suggestions that this commission will say anything that could be perceived as radical or even necessary. Truly reformist. Instead, these are highly respected, you know, wonderful academics who are still quite cautious, usually kind of stick to the center lane, and in my view are very unlikely to come out in favor of anything dramatic to the extent that they even state their opinions.
Okay, so nobody on the commission who's like a full-on advocate for, say, expanding the court. But it does make sense that we would want there to be both the right and the left, right? I mean, the country is divided. This commission isn't going to have much credibility with half the country if there aren't folks from the right. But so what will that mean in the end? I mean, are we going to see a divided report, or do they need to come to consensus? What's the expectation about that?
It looks like from the executive orders that the commission is expected to come to a consensus. There's not an expectation of a majority report and a minority report. Like I said, because there's no action items, the instruction here is just to produce kind of like, a book report, a white paper that goes over the arguments, that goes over the history and legality here. So I think that there's going to be a tendency toward blandness. A tendency toward extreme consensus. And because there's no bomb throwers on this commission, or no one who's even really stuck their neck out at all for real reform, it seems like the arguments and analysis are going to tilt in favor of the status quo.
So have we heard anything from any of the Supreme Court justices themselves about this whole project of restructuring?
We have. You know, historically, sitting justices have not been fans of dramatic reform, unsurprisingly. Just last week, Justice Breyer gave some public remarks where he pushed back on the concept of court packing. You know, the justices are, as a whole, often very, you know, lowercase c conservative when it comes to how the court functions. You know, you've seen that in the opposition to putting cameras in the courtroom. I think to the extent someone wants to come in and dramatically reshape the court, we have seen justices, talk about how that's not good, that politicizes the court. There are no sitting justices. There's no representative of the Supreme Court on this commission. I think from Justice Breyer and going back, we've seen justices make clear that they're not fans of this. I do think one interesting thing to note is that the judiciary as a whole is very in favor of adding judgeships to the lower courts, which is not something that this executive order engages with. For years, the judiciary has asked Congress to add judges to the lower courts. It's not been a partisan issue, although recently I think liberals would love to see the Biden administration get behind that as a way to give Biden more seats to fill. That's not something that this commission is being asked to talk about.
We're almost out of time, but Zoe, what do you think about the timeline? Is 6 months the right amount of time to do this? Is there anything lost by waiting 6 months?
I mean, he's giving academics a lot of time to do what they do best, which is study, engage, get into the literature and the history. But it's time limited, but not by a whole lot. So I think it gives Biden a lot of time, even after the time he's given the commission, to really think about what he wants to do here. But I think no one should expect anything to happen anytime soon.
All right. Zoe Tillman is a senior reporter with BuzzFeed News. Thanks so much, Zoe.
Thanks again.
And Mark Joseph Stern writes about the courts and law for Slate. Thanks for your time, Mark.
Thanks for having me on.
The Union Drive at the Amazon Fulfillment Center in Bessemer, Alabama, is over, at least for now. And according to the ballot count, workers at the facility voted overwhelmingly not to form a union. It's a disappointing result for labor organizers, but definitely not the end of the road. Lauren Kaori Gurley is a senior staff writer at Motherboard, Vice's tech site. She's been covering this story from the start, and she joins me now. Lauren, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hey, Nancy. Thank you so much for having me again.
So this vote wasn't even close. There was so much attention on Bessemer, both nationally and internationally. Were you surprised the union lost by such a big margin?
So yes and no. I think that, just talking to labor organizers before the vote count happened, there were a lot of red flags in terms of the organizing strategies that the union was using. For example, because of COVID, they weren't doing door knocking. They weren't getting big public declarations of support from workers in the form of like people signing things or staging big actions. And part of that was because of retaliation. They were afraid of retaliation, they said. You know, when I was down there, I talked to a lot of workers who said, you know, most people on my shift or whatever either aren't voting or are, you know, very scared of the union and think that if the union comes in, we will lose our jobs. At the same time, you know, obviously there was a huge amount of hope placed on the union drive winning. There was a ton of positive media coverage. There was endorsements from celebrities, politicians. We got even a historic statement from President Biden that we hadn't seen anything like that from a president since FDR, basically. And there was a huge camp of workers who were very pro-union. So I think this was always an uphill battle. And, you know, I think some people were caught off guard when they lost because of all the positive media coverage. But, you know, there was never a level playing field between Amazon and the union in terms of just sheer financial resources and access to workers. So I think this outcome, you know, was expected.
You mentioned that workers were afraid that they would lose their jobs if the plant unionized. Did you hear other reasons why folks didn't vote for the union?
Yeah. So a lot of people were afraid, like I said. The other camp maybe was, you know, people who said that they were more than satisfied with what Amazon offered in, you know, a region in, you know, Alabama in the South where a lot of good paying jobs have left, where a lot of the options are, you know, fast food, retail, minimum wage work. Amazon is offering $15 an hour, which is twice the federal minimum wage and twice Alabama's minimum wage. They offer benefits like healthcare, dental, vision, insurance, retirement plans. And so I think a lot of people were swayed by this anti-union campaign that Amazon held that was basically like, if the union comes in, you could lose all of that. Aren't you, you know, happy with what you already have? Do you really want to be paying dues to this union where, you know, they showed them some contracts at some poultry farms that the union had negotiated where the pay was much lower. And that wasn't really a fair comparison at all because warehouse work pays much more. But I think a lot of workers were really persuaded by Amazon's anti-union messaging. And you know, Amazon poured, you know, tons of resources into this. There were daily text messages. The entire warehouse was plastered with anti-union posters in bathroom stalls, entrances. There were sending out care packages and mailers. It was really, really powerful stuff.
Organized labor pinned so much hope on this campaign. And the fact that it was a place in the South, I think, made it even more of a place to take a stand. So will this loss reverberate beyond the Amazon facility?
You know, I think it's definitely discouraging to, you know, to people who are organizing right now. But I think even the fact that they made it to the point of a union election, which has never happened at an Amazon warehouse in the history of the United States or since the company was founded in the 90s, was a landmark in itself. So you're already seeing people organizing in response to this. You're seeing, the labor movement is obviously recalibrating its strategies after this huge loss. But I think, you know, they've had thousands of workers. This union that organized the Amazon workers in Alabama has had thousands of Amazon workers reach out to them since the pandemic or since the election started about, you know, how do I unionize? So I think really, you know, it is a loss and, you know, people are being discouraged, but I think the bigger thing here is that actually that people are inspired and are organizing, you know, in Iowa and Southern California and New York City and Chicago. So I think we should expect to see more of that.
And what kind of recalibration are you talking about exactly in terms of like, how is it going to change the strategy?
Yeah. So, one of the things that the labor movement is talking about is, you know, maybe we shouldn't be, you know, pouring, you know, tons of resources into union campaigns at individual warehouses. I think they're thinking about maybe a more sector-wide strategy where they will be holding direct actions like walkouts, big publicity campaigns, you know, to sort of shine a light on Amazon's working conditions, you know, more petitions, more strikes, more work stoppages that, you know, sort of get Amazon to sit down at the bargaining table, maybe without a union. That is one of the thoughts. I know that other places, you know, are still interested in holding union campaigns, so that could continue as well.
We're almost out of time, but what happens next with this specific fight with the retail, wholesale, and department store union? How are they going to fight the results?
Right. So they're in the process of filing objections and charges related to Amazon's conduct during the election, which, you know, they had a USPS mailbox installed right feet out from the entrance of the warehouse, and they were texting workers and telling workers to vote from it. This was supposed to be a mail-in election, not on site. And so they're definitely going to launch a case against that. They're also going to request a hearing to determine if the election results should be cast aside entirely. So that could mean that they have to do a revote.
Okay, thanks so much. Lauren Kaori Gurley is a senior staff writer at Motherboard, Vice's tech site. Thanks so much, Lauren.
Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
As vaccine distribution ramps up in the U.S. and in other high-income countries, many others have yet to receive any of the COVID-19 vaccines. In Haiti, where political instability and violence continues to rock the country, not a single dose of the COVID vaccine has been made available for its more than 11 million people. Here to explain why that is Jacqueline Charles, Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. Jacqueline, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
There seems to be a few reasons behind the delayed vaccine campaign in Haiti. So let's start first with the role of bureaucracy. What's causing the holdup there?
Well, you know, Haiti is a country that is known for its bureaucracy. Things normally move very slowly on other issues. But I think with this vaccine, there has been a number of issues that have been further feeding the slow-moving bureaucracy. Let's start with COVID. Haiti has somehow dodged a bullet so far on a high death toll. It's less than 300 deaths in the country, I think a little over 12,000 confirmed cases. And even though we recognize that they have problems in terms of testing, the reality is that you haven't seen in Haiti what we've seen in Brazil or even what we saw in Ecuador last year at the beginning, which is bodies on the ground, people being buried, or even what we saw in Haiti 11 years ago with cholera. So anecdotally, you're not seeing that there are a large number of people who are dying as a result of COVID. Even in the hospitals, you're not seeing high hospitalization rates. And in fact, a year after COVID, a number of COVID treatment centers that opened were closed, including one by Doctors Without Borders, which closed theirs 3 months afterwards because people were just not coming to the hospital. If they were getting COVID, they were not getting severely ill, and somehow they were treating it. The other factor that doctors believe it's because of the young population, more than half of the country's population is under the age of 30. I think over 50% is under the age of 25. But they're still stumped by this and they're still looking into this. So I think that this reality in terms of the profile of the disease in Haiti has been feeding a side debate in terms of whether or not Haiti needs a COVID vaccination, a vaccine. But also, there's been concern in Haiti among government officials about the AstraZeneca vaccine, is what they've told me. And there are two concerns for them. One, of course, they're watching reports about AstraZeneca and the whole issue with blood clots and questioning how safe it is. And we've seen reports that says it is safe. The benefits outweigh the risk in respect to this vaccine. But at the same time, Haiti is a country that has struggled with vaccination, especially when it comes to children. And so for them, it is much more efficient and easier to get somebody in the door for one shot rather than two shots. And this push led to reports even in the Haitian press that said that the Haitian government, the Ministry of Health, had turned down AstraZeneca. I spoke to the director general. He says, no, they did not turn down their vaccine. What they ask is for Gavi and WHO to consider a one-shot vaccine. As we know, Johnson & Johnson is available in the United States, but it has not yet been approved by WHO for emergency use. And therefore, the only vaccine available to Haiti or any country right now through WHO, through the COVAX facility, which is aimed at getting vaccines into the hands of poor and middle-income countries, is the AstraZeneca vaccine.
So, Jacqueline, you were talking about many of the reasons why the vaccination program hasn't gotten underway. And what is the issue with cold storage? Is there the ability to store the vaccine if they were to get it from one of the companies that requires a super low temperature?
Well, yeah, that is also a problem. I mean, we're talking about a country that is just not dealing with a governance issue today, but it has a number of other problems. And according to PAHO, the Pan American Health Organization, a lot of work has gone into helping Haiti prepare. And just to give you an idea of the problems, the cold storage issue is that just, I think, in February, India, which was providing vaccines, AstraZeneca, their version of a Covishield, to countries around the Caribbean and Latin America, they offered Haiti 10,000 doses. And Haiti had to tell them, hey, can you put that on hold because we're not ready? And the director general says, listen, if we got these vaccines and we didn't have the proper storage for the vaccine, then it would have, you know, expired in our hands. And then we would have been further criticized. So a lot of work had to go into Haiti's preparation to receive this vaccine. And, you know, what Gavi is saying, just based on their timeline, the first that they heard from Haiti confirmation that, okay, yes, we'll take the vaccine, was like March 9th. And then Haiti finally had a vote on March 16th, where they agreed that the population needs to be vaccinated. And then they didn't inform Gavi until March 29th. So what you see, just this very slow moving, slow churning bureaucracy, and yet they're still not fully prepared.
Haiti is still seeing violence and political instability stemming from the 2015 election crisis. How does that further complicate the pandemic response?
It does complicate it because what you have is a mistrust of the government. And so when COVID first appeared on the scene, you had a lot of people in Haiti who just really didn't believe that it was real. They felt that it was a ploy by the government to make money. And even today, I mean, the central question when we're thinking about vaccination in Haiti is, how do you convince people to take a vaccine for a disease that they don't believe in? I mean, when Haitians talk about COVID, they say, oh, it's just a little fever, you know. So there's this attitude toward, you know, this pandemic that we see that's ravaging in the U.S. and ravaging elsewhere around the world. But in Haiti, it hasn't had that impact. And so it's a huge challenge. And the government has been challenged in responding and in trying to convince people because of its own problems that it's had. The governance issue, the violence, the kidnappings. I think all of this is factored into the COVID response or lack thereof.
And what's been the U.S. government response, and what can the U.S. government do to help?
You know, that's a very interesting question. I mean, the U.S. government really has been, for me, sort of absent on this whole COVID response. I mean, just a clear example, I mentioned earlier that Doctors Without Borders closed their COVID treatment center 3 months after they opened it. Well, the U.S. provided ventilators after that fact. The ventilators to Haiti from USAID arrived after, you know, COVID centers were closing. It was not at the height of COVID when we were seeing some deaths in Haiti. There were concerns about whether or not Haiti would even be able to address, you know, a COVID outbreak in the country. So in terms of the, you know, the COVID vaccine, the U.S. really has been silent on this. This has really been pushed by the United Nations. They are the ones who have been providing, you know, testing kits. In fact, Haiti wanted to get some testing kits out of the United States. But remember, during the Trump administration, there was a lot of lockdown on products that were made in the United States, PPEs and other things. And so Haiti could not even access COVID testing kits from the United States in order for them to be able to test people for COVID.
Jacqueline Charles is the Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. Jacqueline, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
President Joe Biden recently announced that New York and New Jersey will become a key part of the national wind sector and a step towards fulfilling his campaign promise of achieving 100% renewable energy by 2035. The waters off the coast of Long Island in New Jersey are known as the New York Bight. That's B-I-G-H-T. Under the Biden plan, it'll be designated for wind energy development. The move promises to bring a huge boost in jobs to the area, especially in manufacturing. The ocean represents more than 70% of the Earth's surface and provides half the oxygen we breathe. And unfortunately, it absorbs both the heat from climate change and the CO2 emissions. But the fishing industry has criticized the plan, saying it poses a risk to fishing production and marine health. And there's the catch, because climate activists say without a clean energy transition, there is little hope for continued life in the oceans. Here to explain the wind energy plan is Frank Coomer, a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer who covers local environmental issues in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Frank, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, Nancy, and thanks for having me.
Now, you're based in New Jersey, so can you describe the scope of what we're talking about here? Like, how big of a presence would wind development like this have?
Sure. Let me just give an overall look at New Jersey's consumption right now and energy needs, and then how that transitions to wind. So right now, New Jersey gets about 94% of all its utility scale generation through natural gas and nuclear power. Or the biggest generator of electricity is nuclear. So the state wants to transition to 100% what they call clean energy by 2050, and that would include nuclear power. But the problem is you can't really build any more nuclear power plants. There are three in the state, or it's unlikely that one would be built. So a lot of that gap is going to have to be filled by renewable energy, and New Jersey has a relatively shallow shelf off the coast, and it has relatively steady winds there, so it's suited for offshore wind. So offshore wind is coming to fill in that gap, and there's some ambitious plans for that to generate, I think, 2.1 gigawatt hours by 2050. So it's going to be a big hole to fill.
Governor Phil Murphy also has a plan to build, a manufacturing site on the water to build turbines for the whole East Coast. So, you know, you wrote in one of your stories that wind power could become the biggest job creator since the gambling casinos were legalized in the state. What kind of jobs are we talking about?
Sure. And that assessment was by a pro-business group. So I think that does remain to be seen how many are generated. But you're talking about really everything from welders to painters to iron workers through to accountants, people that map the seafloor, people that can calculate, the amount of wind generated, So it's going to be a lot of different jobs through to engineering, a host of different occupations from blue collar to white collar. And that's going to come through several ports, and that would be the port of Paulsboro, which is going to be the location for the monopile construction. The monopiles are the giant steel foundations that the turbine gets put on top of. And the second component would be the wind port, which New Jersey says is the first purpose-built port for wind in the U.S. And that would be a site of what they call marshalling, where you gather the materials and take them out to sea from the Delaware Bay. So they would sail down the coast and out to off the Atlantic City for the first installment of wind. So they're all different places where jobs will be installed. But the biggest hope, I think, is for the wind port, which would eventually include manufacturing, or the state hopes it will include manufacturing.
There's been a lot of talk about transitioning fossil fuel industry workers into clean energy jobs. Do you think that's a possibility here?
Yes, I do. I think to a degree. I've spoken with people from the Atlantic Shores group, which was formed to bid for the next wind solicitation, which gets announced in June. And the solicitation basically is New Jersey State Board of Public Utilities saying this is the next installment of wind. So it's a fairly large installment, and part of the group that makes that up is Shell. And I spoke to someone that was with the Shell side of operations, and he seemed to feel that there is a pretty good dovetailing of jobs in fossil fuel industry and wind, and that would be through a lot of the construction operations.
And what about the fishing industry? We mentioned at the top that there is worry that this could impact marine life. What have you heard from fishers in the area?
Well, they're definitely concerned. Fishing is a huge industry in New Jersey because of its coast. Obviously, it has a number of commercial fish, squid, scallop, clams, and of course, various types of fin fish that generate tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. And it also has a huge recreational component, which are the charter boats, the party boats, and then just sport anglers with, vessels that can go out to sea and deep sea fish and et cetera. So they're very concerned that this is going to disrupt habitat and fish migration.
Okay, thanks so much. Frank Coomer is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
It's been 5 years since the legendary musician Prince died in 2016 at just 57 years old. And while it's hard to lessen the blow of his untimely death, fans of the Purple One have been able to find some solace in the music that has been posthumously released by his estate in recent years. Last week, Prince's estate announced that Welcome to America, a previously unreleased album, will be coming out at the end of July.
Welcome to America, where you can fail at your job, get fired, rehired, and get a $700 billion tip. Come on in,
sit right down. But alongside the excitement that comes with the new music, the release also raises some ethical questions. Prince recorded Welcome to America in 2010, but chose not to put it out at the time. And whether he ever would have wanted the public to hear it isn't entirely clear.
I'll get down. Transformation happens deep within. Yes.
Knees. Oh, no. With me now is D'Angela Duff, Associate Vice Provost and Industry Professor at New York University, and more importantly, a Prince superfan. Good to have you here, D'Angela.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So what was your reaction when you heard that Welcome to America would be released this summer?
Absolutely. Sheer enthusiasm and very, very, very excited. This is such great news because one of the things that Prince fans look forward to is listening to music that is in Prince's vault. And this is an entire album. So we are thrilled. So this is the first time we're getting a complete project from the vault.
What do we know about why he chose not to release the album anytime during his life, why he put it in the vault.
Well, he actually did that a lot. So this wasn't, you know, an individual instance. What's interesting is that with interviews with Prince, he would either say two things. He would say either, I don't give the record company my best work. He has stated that several times. And then the other is that somebody will put it out someday. I mean, so somebody will do something with it. So he kind of knew, you know, once he passed that more than likely, you know, some of the music was going to, you know, be released from the vault.
This is the second release since he died from the vault. So what's your opinion about the so far what you've been able to hear? Do you think it's true that he was holding back his best work?
Oh, most certainly. The one thing that was released last year by the estate was the Sign of the Times Super Deluxe box set. I mean, that was a massive set. And it was really awesome hearing him perform Power Fantastic with members of the Revolution. And this is the first instance where you could hear Prince giving direction to the band in a studio context. So that was really personal and also got you to see a little bit about, you know, the recording process behind the curtain, so to speak. So that's definitely one instance of that. On the same box set, there's another song called In a Dark Room with No Light, which has been a fan favorite for a long time. And there was a very poor quality audio sort of circulating out there. And now we have a pristine copy. So those are two songs that are just heavenly when you listen to them. But it's so much more. I mean, the estate has been doing a really excellent job with getting new projects out with, you know, unreleased songs from the vault. Another project that they did was The Originals, which was fantastic. It's basically Prince singing the songs that he produced for others. One of those songs was Manic Monday that he produced for the Bangles. So you can hear that. You can hear him singing songs that he would produce for his Prince proteges, you know, such as Vanity Six and The Time on that particular project, Sheila E. So the state has been really good with giving us songs and music from the vault.
Now, I read that there's like a tremendous amount of finished music in the vault. Do we know exactly how much?
We don't know exactly how much, but just imagine Prince basically recorded night and day since, actually before, but professionally since 1978. So by all accounts from, you know, everyone who's worked with him, he never stopped working. So he would often record a song a day. So if you do the math, it's basically thousands of songs. So, you know, sometimes he would rework certain songs. So you might have a song that he recorded like in the late 70s. Another example of this is actually I Can Never Take the Place of Your Man, which is also on the Sign of the Times Super Deluxe box set. But he actually recorded a version in the 80s, then he recorded a version in the late 70s. So sometimes he would revisit work. That was rare, but he did do that sometimes.
Now, Prince had disputes with the record companies, and then you know, there was no will, and there's been a legal battle over his estate. How do you think this is affecting the release of this music from the vault? Is there controversy about it?
Yes. I mean, some fans believe that Prince would not have wanted this music released because it's being released by a record company. I disagree. I do think that Prince knew that his music was going to be released. The controversy for me is whether or not he had a will. By all accounts, they say he didn't have a will. I don't find that to be true, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist. And the reason why I say that is because he fought so hard to get his masters back. You know, he wrote Slave on his face for years and got ridiculed for that. So it just doesn't make any sense to me that he would pass without a will. And basically, he didn't leave any plans for his music. That just, it's unfathomable for me to think of that. So I'm wondering if, like, there's a copy of the will in the vault in something that someone hasn't opened or something. That's actually my wish, because it is kind of wreaking havoc on the estate.
So how much do you think Prince's legacy has shifted in the years since his death?
Actually, I think it's grown larger, which is really fantastic to see. I was just really surprised when Prince passed, how much the world really celebrated his life and his legacy and his music. You know, the Eiffel Tower was purple. Everything turned purple when he passed. And that just let me know that, you know, Prince did leave a mark on the world. And I think with all of these posthumous releases, you know, the world is saying that he was a true musician. He was a true artist. He dedicated his life to his art. And the critics and fans alike are revisiting some of his past material. I mean, Prince released 39 albums in his lifetime, but there are many more albums actually in the vault that the state can release. So I'm just thrilled at how Prince is still very relevant 5 years later.
It's like he was creating his own immortality during his lifetime. It's really extraordinary. D'Angela Duff is an associate vice provost and industry professor at New York University. Thanks so much, D'Angela.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Nancy.
That's all we have for you today, folks. It's been a true pleasure filling in for Tanzina. She'll be back in the chair Wednesday, and tomorrow it'll be Rebecca Ibarra. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Nancy Solomon, and this is The Takeaway.